Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's 331-point plunge of the Dow Jones, together with the euro falling to a 9-year low against the dollar, as investors react to falling oil prices and the prospect of Greece leaving the eurozone. Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute and a professor of economics at Bard College, joins us to discuss the upcoming January the 25th election in Greece that is likely to bring the anti-austerity left-wing Syriza party to power, sparking fears that Greece will reject terms of the EU, ECB and IMF bailouts and exit from the euro. Then, as the 114th Congress, which is 80% white, 80% male and 92% Christian, prepares to open for business on Tuesday, we'll examine the likely impact of full GOP control of Congress and whether there will be more stalemate in Washington, with the president trying to defend his policies and legacy and a new Republican majority who have spent the last 6 years trying to destroy Obama's presidency. Ira Shapiro, who spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and is the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, joins us to discuss whether Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader McConnell can move from a policy of obstruction to the practice of governing. Then finally, we will look into the interesting addition to the Eurasia Group's just published top 10 geopolitical risks of 2015. That is the weaponization of finance. Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, joins us to discuss his article in the Washington Post, The Most Interesting Geopolitical Risks of 2015, and the use of finance as a weapon that is arguably more potent than the Pentagon's nuclear arsenal and carrier battle groups, the power of the U.S. Treasury to use the carrot of access to capital markets and the stick of economic sanctions. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute, the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College, and he has testified often at the United States Senate and House Committee hearings and was vice president of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council's Sub-Council on Capital Allocation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation.
And Dimitri, the elections, the polls indicate in Greece now that Syriza has a chance of winning. It's ahead in the polls. There obviously is time left before the January the 25th election. And my understanding is that the other parties are basically saying the sky will fall if Syriza gets elected. But, you know, Greece has borrowed $286 billion. That's not small change, is it?
No, it's not. Of course, it is going to be a change in government. I think in all likelihood we will see a Syriza government that we know has pronounced the bailouts as a provided a catastrophic repercussions in Greece with huge unemployment, unprecedented levels of unemployment, with loss of income of more than 30%, with loss of output of more than 25%, and the minuses keep going. So, yes, we will see a new government. I do not believe that this is tantamount to Greece exiting the euro. This is a tactic that is being used by both the current government, its pronouncements, as well as the intervention that comes either from Germany or from the European Commission, which is unprecedented. You know, it is like having President Obama going to Germany and saying to Angela Merkel, you know, I don't think you should, or it is not, but tend to the German people, I don't think you should vote for the SPD. It would have been a political earthquake if, in fact, this were to happen. But somehow or other, it's allowed to happen in Greece and in other small European countries that have been under the imposition of austerity and a bailout from Brussels and primarily from Germany.
But I imagine that Angela Merkel is not particularly popular in Greece. So would that tactic work, where she clearly did intervene in Greece's domestic politics?
But she does intervene a different way, as through her spokespeople, whether these people are Wolfgang Schäuble or other members of her government, by saying that Greece must abide by the rules and conditionalities that have been agreed upon by the current government. And she knows that if Syriza were to win, this is not their platform. And if they were elected by the will of the Greek people, this is what they will try to actually topple, that the austerity measures that have been a disaster, not only for Greece, but we see what's happening in the whole European Union and Eurozone. That's why, just to move to another topic in some ways, but related, that Mario Draghi has basically used a panoply of the ECB through the LTRO, to buy as many securities as possible in order to avert the disaster that is coming as a result of the deflationary pressures, as well as the abysmal growth prospects for both big economies, Italy or France.
And again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified often at Senate and House committee hearings and was vice president of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council Sub-Council on Capital Allocation. So, Dimitri, how do you explain the contradiction between the polls in Greece saying that Syriza is ahead for the January the 25th elections? At the same time, they say that 60% of Greeks want to stay in the EU.
Well, but it is not synonymous that Syriza's popularity is equated with exiting the euro. Syriza has made a commitment that the negotiations will take place with Greece staying in the euro. And I think that there is a very good chance that the headwinds in the Eurozone will change. We see some of changes that have been coming out from members of the chancellors, experts of economic advisors, such as Peter Bofinger, for instance, who is suggesting that so far, Germany has contributed zero to the growth prospects of the Eurozone, and therefore it cannot assume that Greece is going to exit the Euro. First of all, I don't believe that Germany or any other nation actually knows what will happen if, in fact, this were to take place. We don't know what the contagion effect will be. We don't know what the impact is going to be on the banking, on the depositors of various banks in Portugal, in France, or in Italy, if in fact it's allowed that Greece gets out or exits the euro. The depositors will not feel very comfortable in terms of what will happen, since neither France nor Italy are willing to abide by the austerity measures, and therefore they might find themselves in a similar situation later on. So I think that the contagion effect for a possibility of Greece exiting the euro is not actually taken into consideration, and one does not know. Now, is it possible that the Eurozone will risk having one of its members exiting the euro? And what would prevent another member leaving the euro?
Well, already there's if you will, a political contagion on the left. Not that I'm in any way decrying Syriza, but they literally have sort of come out of nowhere and very quickly and are now ahead in the polls in the upcoming January, the 25th election. But Podemos, this brand new party in Spain, is at 22% already, and it came out of nowhere. So there's something happening politically, surely.
Well, there are ideological shifts because of what is happening in the standard of living of individuals. And you can wait for 23 continuous quarters, in the case of Greece, of decline in growth and a recession. But there is a limit. And I think the limit has been reached, and that's why we will see most likely a change in government with Syriza that will go against the current wisdom, which has failed miserably.
So with $286 billion having been borrowed by Greece, obviously there are a lot of people with a stake in the outcome of this election. How does it relate? You mentioned earlier Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, the European Central Bank, issuing the equivalent of what they call quantitative easing over here by the Fed. Just explain the logic of that.
Well, you know, first of all, Draghi is not doing it because of Greece. I think Draghi is doing it because of what he sees is happening in the Eurozone. And unfortunately, he's coming too late and too little. It is not going to have a big impact. As we have seen, it didn't have an impact for the Federal Reserve. It was only the fiscal stimulus that President Obama started in $787 billion that actually started the economy moving. It's fiscal policy that it's potent and not monetary policy. Not that we do not need monetary policy, and especially in Greece, since there is so much lack of liquidity, and therefore there's no lending going on because of the difficulties that the country is facing under the fact that it is in a recession. And no business will actually borrow money if it knows that it has no idea whether whatever he or she is going to produce as an entrepreneur will be sold, since the domestic consumption has dropped dramatically. So to come back to your question about quantitative easing, I think it's absolutely necessary that it takes place, but we should not expect that there will be a turnaround within the economies of the Eurozone, France and Italy and Spain and Portugal. So these are big economies and small economies together.
But the actual, unlike what happened here in 2008, where the private banks on Wall Street crashed the economy and exposed the government to enormous bailouts. In this case, the European Central Bank, the IMF, are basically holding the bag, aren't they? And European private banks aren't holding the bag, are they? In terms of this $286 billion.
Well, actually, it's a little bit less than that. It's about $260 billion, uh-huh, because it's about 80% of the total of €320 billion. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the private sector holdings, or these holdings that by the private sector, are not going to be affected because they already have had a haircut. So mm-hmm. The question now is about the official sector, which is the IMF, the ECB, and the the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism. But the issue here is, how do you tell your voters in Germany that you made a mistake and Greece now is leaving the euro? Because if Greece were to leave the euro, of course, those money are going to be lost. Whether, in fact, you're going to now have, especially in Germany, about an 80 or a 90 billion euro loss. So it isn't as easy to assume to somehow to jump to a conclusion just because Syriza is going to win, in all likelihood, it is a given that Greece is going to exit the euro.
So we've spoken in the past about the European economic malaise, and is it and about the counterproductive nature of austerity, and it's been manifestly proven. What explains this long resistance on the part of Germany? Because Germany has been the major beneficiary of the euro, surely.
That's exactly the reason, because they have been the beneficiary. And by the latest calculations, between 2014 and 2020, Germany is to gain, by being a member of the Eurozone, over 1.3 trillion euros. So if you have this in front facing you, you wouldn't want to do anything different other than to continue the present policy. It is so ironic that Germany does not see that, in fact, it cannot be the only motor of growth in the Eurozone. That's not really what the union is all about. And what they have transformed is a union of growth to a union of austerity.
Well, they've also, it seems, in the popular media and in the politics, and particularly in Germany, they seem to have demonized or made this division between the North and the South, between, if you will, the Protestant North and the Catholic South, the hardworking tax-paying Northerners and the freeloading Southerners. And there's a manifestation also now in Germany of anti-immigrant prejudice. There's demonstrations both to and against, both for and against immigrants. But it does seem that there hasn't been a lot of political honesty, shall we say, in Germany.
Yes, but you know, we should see that even in Germany, people are not really very happy with what's happening. That's why we see the rise of the Alternative Party, which is now rising in population. It entered the European Parliament, and if elections were to be held today in Germany, I'm not sure the results would be the same as it was last year. So I think that the German elite, political elite, I think is paying attention to that, because next door to them, we know that Marine Le Pen is actually if in fact elections were to be held there today. So this is not something to be actually disregarded. And my suspicion is that the whole Euro project finally will see, at least the people who are responsible for running the Euro, the Eurozone, will see the necessity of changing its architecture.
Well, the rise of these right-wing parties is obviously in response to a lot of this, if you will, propaganda. But my understanding also is that Vladimir Putin is funding a lot of these right-wing. He's funding Jobbik and Le Pen.
Le Pen, yes. Yeah. But, you know, nobody knows anything about that. It's somehow or other we are creating sanctions for Putin. On the other hand, we allow Russian banks to actually provide loans to those extreme right parties. All in all, I think that where we're headed is really for a collision course, and this is not something that it is only from Greece. I think that Syriza might be the catalyst for all things to happen, as you mentioned before, the Podemos rise, as well as other parties in the rest of the Eurozone, not necessarily on the left side, but primarily on the right side.
Well, so the left rises in Greece and Spain, and the right rises everywhere else.
I don't know about Italy. I mean, it's possible you may have actually the left-leaning party as well.
Right. Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate the conversation, Dimitri.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who is the president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He has testified numerous times at Senate and House Committee hearings and was vice president of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and was a member of the Competitiveness Policy Council's Sub-Council on Capital Allocation. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the makeup of the 114th Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has an op-ed at the Washington Post, The Most Interesting Geopolitical Risk of 2015. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Dresner.
Thank you for having me.
And it would seem that in the 21st century, in this post-Cold War era, although many say a new Cold War is brewing, but nevertheless, it does seem that in many ways the Treasury Department has more power than the Pentagon in terms of what, for example, has been the response to Vladimir Putin. You think this is a growing trend?
I do think it's a growing trend. I don't know if it would be accurate to say that the Treasury Department has more power. It would be more that Washington is more willing to use the tools of the Treasury Department than they are the tools of the Pentagon. We're now in an era where, across the board, regardless of partisan affiliation, there's a fair amount of wariness with respect to the use of military force. And there are a lot of situations where the use of financial sanctions seems to be the more attractive option, even if it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And the other thing that should be pointed out is that the U.S. government has gotten better at using this tool, in the sense of financial sanctions now generally cost the target far more than they used to.
Well, sanctions sort of used to be a palliative for policymakers who sort of used them in frustration that there were no other alternatives. But it does seem that now they are more effective. And it also appears that Vladimir Putin, for example, who many argue is running a kleptocracy, when you consider that as some estimates indicate that up to half of the global economy is a black economy, an underground economy. If you combine a nation state with a black global economy, that's a powerful and threatening portent, isn't it?
First of all, I'm a little dubious about that half figure. I don't doubt there's a large gray market economy, but I don't know if it's quite that large. But in some ways, that's what makes the financial sanction even more powerful, which is to say that even if there's a large black market economy, that large black market economy is meaningless unless the profits from it can be deposited into a financial institution, and usually, more importantly, converted into the world's reserve currency, which is dollars. And that's a major lever that the United States holds, particularly if the European Union acts with it, which is to say that if it decides that a particular country or a particular financial institution is going to get cut off from the rest of the global financial system, that institution is going to get cut off, and it'll suffer serious damage as a result of that. So I think the first sort of 21st century example of this was when there were sanctions placed actually on a North Korean bank for a variety of reasons. And North Korea, even though they've been under sanctions for decades, they actually yelped on that one because that actually hurt. And then obviously the more recent examples are Iran and Russia.
Well, I think the U.S. used its financial muscle against Milosevic too, didn't it? Back during the Balkan Wars.
I would say that those sanctions were not nearly as important. And just as significant, in some ways, this is sort of the evolution of economic sanctions. It used to be that when you would talk about economic sanctions, you were usually talking about trade sanctions. And those were, among other things, employed against Slobodan Milosevic's Serbia. Increasingly, the kinds of sanctions that are now being employed, sometimes there's trade elements to it, but it's much more on the financing side. And because the global financial system is now so heavily integrated, it winds up being a more surgical form of sanction, because the common lament about these things used to be that if you employed trade sanctions, you were hurting the population even more than you were hurting the elites. In the case of financial sanctions, you're still hurting the population, but you're hurting the elite even more. And so politically, they seem to have a little more leverage.
Well, my understanding, Daniel Dresner, is that people like Vladimir Putin and the Siloviki, the former intelligence officials, the kleptocrats surrounding him, who have become oligarchs, they're somewhat torn. On the one hand, they basically run a criminal economy, but on the other hand, they which undermines global finance. But on the other hand, they want global financial stability to protect their money, which they parked abroad.
That's exactly correct, which is to say that even corrupt or black market activities, in the end, they actually need a stable financial system in order to be able to park their assets and park their profits. So you're right. On the one hand, the Russian economy is safely described as a kleptocracy in a lot of ways. And really what's happening is that the sort of plutocrats surrounding Putin are between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they're terribly worried about having their assets seized if they stay in the West. On the other hand, they're also terribly worried that if they keep their assets in Russia, they'll be vulnerable to Vladimir Putin's caprice, and he is certainly not above arresting billionaires that he doesn't like.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Drasner, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has an op-ed at the Washington Post, The Most Interesting Geopolitical Risk of 2015. And that refers, of course, to the Eurasia Group's top risks of 2015, a report that just came out. Number one, the politics of Europe. Number two, Russia. Number three, effects of China slowdown. Number four, weaponization of finance, which we're talking about. Number five, ISIS beyond Iraq and Syria. Number six, weak incumbents. Number seven, the rise of strategic sectors. Number eight, Saudi Arabia versus Iran. Number nine, Taiwan, China. And number 10, Turkey. Now, just returning to Putin, he has made it pretty clear, hasn't he, that he wants to get out of the international internet regime, which is dominated by the U.S. and that certainly bothers him. But he's also would like to get out of the SWIFT regime, would he not? The international clearance mechanism, which I take it the U.S. essentially controls.
He's probably reluctant about the extent to which the U.S. controls the SWIFT regime. My understanding is that actually Russia is still participating in the SWIFT regime, and that would actually be the sanction that would in some ways be a step too far for Putin, that could actually cause this sort of, you know, economic conflict to escalate into a more militarized dispute between the United States and Russia. So I'm sure he would like to be outside the aegis of U.S. influence over SWIFT. The problem is in a lot of these cases, when you're talking about financial statecraft, is the acronym TINA, which is to say there is no alternative. There is simply no alternative to using the dollar as the world's, as the reserve currency, as the hard currency. There is not much of an alternative to U.S. capital markets. So as a result, even if Russia might resent U.S. hegemony in this area, there's not much it can do about it.
Well, the almighty dollar, the U.S. dollar, is 22% of global GDP, but it is 81% of global trade finance. So
exactly.
There you have
it. The U.S. economy in terms of as a share of the global economy has stayed roughly constant between about 20 and 25% over the last 10 or 15 years or so. What's remarkable is that despite the 2008 financial crisis, the U.S. dollar is actually, and U.S. capital markets are even more important now than they were prior to the 2008 financial crisis in terms of the global financial system. So in some ways, a lot of people predicted, given that the epicenter of that crisis was the United States, that there would be a reaction by a whole bunch of countries to somehow diversify away from the dollar, to hedge against it, or to find other capital markets. In fact, the exact opposite has occurred.
So this rather opaque group, the Shanghai Cooperative Council, which consists of periodic meetings between Russia, China, and Iran, the assumption has been that they're trying to figure out ways to get around the U.S.'s domination of global finance. And there's always been perennial talks of back to the days of Saddam Hussein, that he's going to somehow switch his oil into euro denomination or some other currency. Where do those speculations stand?
Oil's not going to be redenominated away from the dollar anytime soon, because that's up to Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia remains an ally of the United States. As to the possibility of other sort of non-dollar arrangements, you are starting to see China in particular take a few small moves in that direction, which is they're trying to internationalize the use of the renminbi, its currency, not for finance so much as for trade invoicing and so forth. And you've also seen the creation of two new international financial institutions centered in Shanghai. One is called the BRICS Development Bank, and that's by the BRICS grouping, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And the other is something called the AIDB, which is the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank. Both of these are basically being bankrolled by China, and the potential for them, if they were truly ramped up, is that they could serve as sort of rivals to the traditional international financial institutions, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. But right now you're talking about a very embryonic stage of both of these structures. And it's not at all obvious that, in fact, China really wants the renminbi to become the world's reserve currency. For that to happen, China would have to completely liberalize its financial sector, and right now it's in no position to do that. It doesn't want to, and it would in some ways contravene its development model. So this is at least a decade away from happening. But it could happen at some point down the road if China's economy was to continue to grow very robustly, and if the other sort of if China's neighbors did not see it as a security threat. But the probability of those two things happening are actually not that great.
So, Daniel Dresden, when we talked earlier about the idea that the Treasury Department has more power than the nuclear arsenal of the Pentagon or the carrier battle groups, clearly military power and financial leverage are not mutually exclusive. How would you calibrate them?
Well, I mean, the question is, what is your foreign policy goal? Is the best way to put it. So there are certain things for which sanctions, even the best sanctions, are not going to achieve. Generally speaking, the sort of larger the foreign policy issue, the less likely sanctions are going to work. It's worth remembering that the most powerful sanctions employed in history were probably the United Nations sanctions that were deployed against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Those sanctions were estimated to cost Iraq roughly half its GDP in 1990. That's incredibly massive. And yet Saddam Hussein in the end, you know, was not going to relinquish Kuwait except by military force. So generally speaking, if your goal is to seek regime change or the shifting of territorial boundaries, pretty much the only way that's going to happen is through force. It's not going to happen through economic statecraft. And then the other thing to consider, frankly, is that generally speaking, sanctions are far more likely to work under two sets of conditions. The first is when what you're asking for is incredibly well defined. So one of the reasons that sanctions might have a decent chance of working with Iran is because you're really starting to see the nitty-gritty being negotiated in terms of Iran's nuclear program. And it's become clear to Iran's regime that the sanctions aren't merely about regime change. They really are about curbing that country's nuclear program. The second thing is the extent to which the sanctioned country and the sanctioning country view themselves as allies or adversaries. If they view themselves as adversaries, then even really powerful sanctions will be limited in terms of their effect, which is why the current U.S. and European sanctions against Russia, even though they're having catastrophic effects on the Russian economy, aren't causing Russia to do much in the way of concessions. So in that instance, you have to view the sanctions not so much as a way of extracting concessions, but really in some ways as a form of economic containment.
So in terms of risk, though, what does the Eurasia Group mean when they place the weaponization of finance on the number four slot on their global risks of 2015? What's the risk involved here?
The Eurasia Group's concern, which is not entirely unjustifiable, is the notion that because the U.S. has become so attracted to this tool of financial statecraft and because it's become so well-honed, that the United States might become sanctions-happy. And that it'll start using it on just about any country that disagrees with it. And the concern is that over time, this will cause a lot of the rest of the world to become fearful of sort of U.S. caprice with respect to its capital markets and then potentially find alternatives to both the dollar and U.S. capital markets. Now, I think for 2015, this concern is somewhat exaggerated. The one risk that I do share with the Eurasia Group is that if these sanctions are imposed by Congress, it becomes that much tougher to reverse them. And if Congress winds up becoming the lead actor in terms of imposing some of these sanctions. And you saw that most recently with the Cromnibus bill, which caused additional sanctions to be placed on Russia that the Obama administration didn't want. Then I can sort of see that concern. But again, this goes back to the TINA point, which is there is no alternative at this point. So while this might breed some resentment, there's not necessarily going to be any short-term move away from the dollar because of this.
Well, isn't there, though, when I mentioned earlier about 50% of the global economy being the black economy or underground economy, it may be a loose, certainly a loose statistics, but because I think it also involves, countries like Italy and Greece, where so much of the economy is off the books and people don't pay their taxes, and in so much of the third world, it's pretty difficult to determine those kind of figures as well. But my understanding is that in terms of honing this so-called weapon of finance, that one of the problems is that so many wealthy Americans and wealthy, wealthy global elite and big corporations use offshore banking as well. So, is it hard to penetrate the that kind of world because you have both Putin's dirty money and Apple's hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever being hidden?
Well, those are sort of an apples and oranges kind of problem. You're right in the sense that, you know, a lot of U.S. corporations through things like inversion and using offshore financial centers, find ways to minimize their tax obligations as much as possible. That's not illegal, so it's not like the Treasury Department is going to decide to sanction Apple for that kind of activity. What it will do, and what, you know, the Treasury Department is increasingly able to do because it has a very robust financial intelligence unit, is track the sort of dark pools of money that you're talking about that either come from corrupt dictators or from corrupt regimes. So one of the interesting things with respect to the way that the U.S. employed sanctions against Russia was that one of the first round of sanctions went after a bank that not a lot of people had heard of from Russia, but that clearly was important because it was obvious that a lot of Putin's cronies relied on that bank as a way of getting money out of the system. So what the kinds of sanctions that you're seeing deployed suggest that it's not just the ability to sanction, it's also the intelligence that you have about the sort of flow of these kinds of dark pools. And you also see that in the case of U.S. prosecution of European banks that have been accused of various sorts of financial abuses, ranging from manipulating LIBOR to laundering money for corrupt dictators.
Well, Daniel Dresner, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Dresner, who is a professor of international politics at Tufts University and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has an op-ed at the Washington Post, The Most Interesting Geopolitical Risk of 2015. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the new 114th Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ira Shapiro, who is an international lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. His latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ira Shapiro.
Ian, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
And Ira, do you see any courage and statesmanship on the horizon as the 114th Congress prepares to go to work tomorrow?
Well, look, particularly for a Democrat, it's easy to be pessimistic given a strong Republican majority coupled with a record number of House Republicans. Buttressed by stunning victories around the country. And yet, when you look more closely in the last 2 months, we've had, since the election, President Obama seems like quite a vigorous seventh-year president. He's made a good deal of progress in terms of international negotiations and shown a willingness to use his rulemaking authority. Interestingly, he also got through a record number of judicial appointments last year, something that many of us, and I know you felt this way, many of us have been very worried about in the previous years. So it's an interesting situation. We now have Mitch McConnell confronting the need to actually be constructive, and he has sort of announced that his goal is not to frighten anyone, and to run the Senate the way George Mitchell ran it when he was the leader, which is kind of a remarkable model to use. So I think we'll see what happens.
Well, this is, of course, the 140th Congress is 80% white, 80% male, and 92% Christian. And there's already some problems with the number three leader in the House, who gave a speech to a white supremacist group and apparently described himself as David Duke without baggage. Already the White House has weighed in on that. The press secretary today suggested that this could be a reflection of the so-called values of the Republicans. So how much do you think they are out of touch with the rest of America? Because I suppose, arguably, in a democracy, over half of America. In fact, I think the last election was one of the lowest turnouts in history, wasn't it? And most of those people who didn't show up were Democrats.
It was a very low turnout election, as you said, Ian. I think it was the lowest since 1942. But look, by any measure, we are a deeply and closely divided country. If you look at the 2004 presidential election, or you look at the 2012 presidential election, if you look ahead to the next presidential election, it will undoubtedly be extremely close. If you could get even money that nobody's going to get more than 51.5% either way. The Republicans have done a good job during the last campaign cycle in keeping their extremists under control. They picked more seemingly moderate and accomplished candidates. They didn't nominate any witches or any extremists that had cost them so much in the past. And that's going to be the challenge for McConnell and Boehner. McConnell said just yesterday, "My goal is to convince the country that there is no danger to them in having a Republican Congress and then a Republican president, a right-of-center government that can work." And that's what he's talking about. Whether he can tamp down his extremists remains to be seen.
But do you think, Ira Shapiro, that we are heading towards a kind of a frozen, divided government in the United States where, because of gerrymandering, the Republicans are pretty much going to control the House forever? And, we already have this anomaly now with the fact that the 46 senators in the minority in the United States Senate in the 140th Congress They got 20 million more votes than the 54 Republicans who now make up the new majority in the Senate.
Well, I'm deeply concerned about it. I think that more than the results of any one election, the danger is dysfunctional, paralyzed government. Used to be when, I mean, I wasn't happy when Nixon was elected president or Reagan or either of the Bushes. But the government functioned. We moved to 140-yard line as opposed to the other 40-yard line. But both parties felt the responsibility to govern. We've lost that capacity, and that's what needs to be regained. And I've been more optimistic than some people, and I've been proven wrong in the past. So we'll see. I think that there are a lot of people in Washington who are tired of being there and doing nothing. Let's see if they can overcome the gridlock.
And again, I'm speaking with Ira Shapiro, who's an international lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader, and his latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. So if we are in for this, because I forgot to mention in terms of the bad news for Democrats, the fact that at the state level, the Republicans not only have they conducted, they've raised an awful lot more money because of Citizens United, they have been able to we have this peculiar trend now in American politics where we have more money being spent on elections and fewer people voting, and that may be also another trend, at least that's what happened in 2014. But, the impression you get is that that the Democrats are asleep at the switch at the state level, that the Republicans control a record number of state governorships and state legislatures. They've got the trifecta, I think, in something like two-thirds of all states.
They control, I think, 32 governorships and 68 out of 98 state legislative bodies. There's no doubt that what they did in 2010, when they won an overwhelming victory and then got control over the census process in many of the states, was crucial. But look, one of the things about our system, and one of the only things that I'm positive about in our political system, is that it's fiercely competitive. Just a couple of years ago, the Republicans looked up and said, we can't match the Democrats in the way they have their analytics and the way they're using the new technology. So the Democrats have won. We used to lose presidential elections regularly. Now we've won four out of the last six and five in terms of popular vote. It's going to be fiercely competitive. It's going to be fiercely competitive and continue to be.
But the time when the Democrats really did control all branches of government and got things done, you have to more or less go back to LBJ. And surely a big part of that was quite simply that they had ideas, they had programs, they were on top of big movements, they were on the right side of history, they were engaged. I just don't sense any kind of coherence. There's no message coming from Democrats.
Well, after the election, Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post wrote, if the Democrats have any good candidates or good ideas, it would be nice to hear from them. They showed nothing in the last election, and they ran away from virtually any accomplishments that President Obama had, which I think was a mistake. But look, Ian, when you point to LBJ in 64, 65, or you point to FDR back in the 30s, there have been very few periods in our politics that are like that. Mostly, our politics are far more divided, far more messy, and work, if to the extent they work, it's because of the ability of both parties to recognize their obligation to find compromises. That's what we've lost in recent years. I described Senator McConnell in an article in May. I wrote that he was the most destructive Senate leader because he was a very effective Republican leader, but he was unable to rise above his partisanship in any way. It'll be interesting to see if being majority leader changes him at all.
Well, from the very first day that Obama was elected, the Republicans got together and had a meeting to decide how to destroy him. And McConnell publicly stated that his number one goal was to destroy the Obama presidency. So,
absolutely. And what he figured out was that ultimately the governing party, would pay the price if he was effective at obstruction. And he didn't win in 2012, but he did win in 2014. Now let's see if he has to change his course at all.
But he won in 2014 because the Democratic candidate ran away from Obama, ran away from Obamacare that's incredibly popular in Kentucky, to the extent that Mitch McConnell campaigned saying that I will kill Obamacare at the federal level, but we can keep it here in Kentucky at the state level, which, of course,
right.
is a total lie.
Right.
I mean, that gets to your point about, you know, these candidates that they put up and the lack of a message, surely.
No, it was look, Alison Grimes, who was presumably a promising candidate, wouldn't even say whether she had voted for Obama. And so she supposedly was running this strong race, and she ended up being blown out by 15 points because she clearly stood for nothing. Those kind of candidates never do well.
Well, but the state from which the number three Republican who's now in trouble for addressing a white supremacist group, Steve Scalise from Louisiana, the recent election, this weird sort of after election that took place, it's a sort of vestige of Jim Crow that Mary Landrieu lost, and it's pretty hard for Landrieu to lose in Louisiana. Apparently, they blitz the airwaves with pictures of Landrieu and Obama. Landrieu and Obama, they just literally tied the black man to the white woman. I mean, it was pretty flagrant, apparently. I've talked to people down in Louisiana that just said it was the racist undertone was inescapable. So that's a pretty depressing picture, isn't it?
Well, look, the direction of the Southern voting is very depressing. The Democrats, liberal Democrats, whether it was Mondale or Kerry, didn't do well with Southern white votes, but they did a lot better than Obama did. So certainly it's a depressing commentary.
So what is there then that we can look towards in these next 2 years? And of course, they're going to be talking about the presidential race ad nauseum in that period. But in terms of waking up with the 114th Congress tomorrow, is there anything except, a bleak prognosis, particularly if you're on the political left? I mean, already in that last compromise that they did, there's so many things in that don't make any sense. For example, cutting the funding of the IRS. And I just spoke yesterday with Ed Kleinbart, who was the chief of staff of the Joint Tax Committee of the U.S. House and Senate. And he said now the Republicans are coming up with a new way to score the budget. So when they get tax cuts through, which have to be analyzed by the CBO in terms of their impact on government revenues, they're changing the methodology to make it all look rosy, that tax cuts for the wealthy aren't going to affect the deficit. And these are deficit hawks, for God's sake.
I think the number of areas where they will be able to accomplish things together are relatively few. I would hope, it happens that I'm pro-trade, so many Democrats don't agree with me on this, but I would hope that the particularly the Asian trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, will go forward. I would hope that they will find a way to really agree that it isn't political to try to improve the nation's infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, and our internet. Beyond that, I would say that we're going to see a lot of battling over the scope of President Obama's regulatory authority, going from immigration to his efforts to reduce emissions, particularly coal emissions. We're going to see a lot of fighting over at the periphery of Obamacare as well. And frankly, I think Obama will wield his veto pen in a way that he hasn't done yet. And McConnell will try to pass bills and force Obama to veto certain things in order to present the country with a somewhat clear choice in 2016.
So that might be the only reason why Boehner and McConnell moderate their behavior, is that they're afraid that they might spoil or muddy or make it impossible for a Republican candidate to become the president. Is that?
Well, I think that they, you know, McConnell, I was going to say McConnell's nothing if he's not transparent. He was transparent about his interest in opposing Obama and bringing him down. And now he's pretty transparent in the fact of saying we have a responsibility to govern and show the country that we're not particularly frightening. Time will tell if he can do it. But he definitely sees himself as responsible for controlling his extremists, working with the House of Representatives, either finding places to compromise with the president or finding ways of drawing the line clearly for 2016.
Well, Ira Shapiro, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, Ian, thanks so much. It's always good to talk to you.
Likewise, Ira. And again, I've been speaking with Ira Shapiro, who's an international lawyer in Washington, D.C. He spent 12 years in the United States Senate as counsel to the majority leader and in other senior positions where he played an important role in implementing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Senate Code of Ethics, and the completion of the D.C. Metro Rail System. His latest book is The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. Where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.